Chapter 29. Phyllis thanked him for his beautiful gift, but the talking was soon entirely on Humphrey's side as they walked along. He told her of the latest movements of the world of fashion, a subject which he willingly discussed to the exclusion of anything more personal, and his measured language helped to still her disquieted heart and brain. Had not her own sadness been what it was, she must have observed his embarrassment. At last he abruptly changed the subject. "I am glad you are pleased with my little present," he said. "The truth is that I brought it to propitiate you, and to get you to help me out of a mighty difficulty." It was inconceivable to Phyllis that this independent bachelor whom she admired in some respects could have a difficulty. "Phyllis, I'll tell you my secret at once, for I have a monstrous secret to confide before I can ask your counsel. The case is, then, that I am married. Yes, I have privately married a dear young belle, and if you knew her, and I hope you will, you would say everything in her praise. But she is not quite the one that my father would have chose for me. You know the paternal idea as well as I, and I have kept it secret. There will be a terrible noise, no doubt, but I think that with your help I may get over it. If you would only do me this good turn, when I have told my father, I mean say, that you never could have married me, you know, or something of that sort, upon my life it will help to smooth the way vastly. I am so anxious to win him round to my point of view, and not to cause any estrangement." What Phyllis replied she scarcely knew, or how she counseled him as to his unexpected situation. Yet the relief that his announcement brought her was perceptible. To have confided her trouble in return was what her aching heart longed to do, and had Humphrey been a woman she would instantly have poured out her tale. But to him, she feared to confess, and there was a real reason for silence, till a sufficient time had elapsed to allow her lover and his comrade to get out of harm's way. As soon as she reached home again, she sought a solitary place, and spent the time in half regretting that as he had not gone away, and in dreaming over the meetings with Matt Faustina from their beginning to their end. In his own country, amongst his own countrywomen, he would possibly soon forget her, even to her very name. Her listlessness was such that she did not go out of the house for several days. There came a morning which broke in fog and mist, behind which the dawn could be discerned in greenish gray, and the outlines of the tents, and the rows of horses at the ropes. The smoke from the canteen fires drooped heavily. The spot at the bottom of the garden, where as he had been accustomed to climb the wall to meet Matthaus, was the only inch of English ground in which she took any interest. And in spite of the disagreeable haze prevailing, she walked out there till she reached the well-known corner. Every blade of grass was weighted with little liquid globes, and slugs and snails had crept out upon the plots. She could hear the usual faint noises from the camp, and in the other direction the trot of farmers on the road to the town, for it was market day. She observed that her frequent visits to this corner had quite trodden down the grass in the angle of the wall, and left marks of garden soil on the stepping stones by which as he had mounted to look over the top. Seldom having gone there till dusk, as he had not considered that her traces might be visible by day. Perhaps it was these which had revealed her trysts to her father. While she paused in melancholy regard, she fancied that the customary sounds from the tents were changing their character. Indifferent as Phyllis was to camp doings now, she mounted by the steps to the old place. What she beheld at first awed and perplexed her. Then she stood rigid, her fingers hooked to the wall, her eyes staring out of her head, and her face as if hardened to stone. On the open green stretching before her, all the regiments in the camp were drawn up in line, in the mid-front of which two empty coffins lay on the ground. The unwonted sounds which as he had noticed came from an advancing procession. It consisted of the band of the York Hussars playing a dead march. Next, two soldiers of that regiment in a mourning coach, guarded on each side, and accompanied by two priests. Behind came a crowd of rustics who had been attracted by the event. The melancholy procession marched along the front of the line, returned to the center, and halted beside the coffins, where the two condemned men were blindfolded, and each placed kneeling on his coffin. A few minutes' pause was now given, while they prayed. A firing party of 24 men stood ready with leveled carbines. The commanding officer, who had his sword drawn, waved it through some cuts of the sword exercise till he reached the downward stroke, whereat the firing party discharged their volley. The two victims fell, one upon his face across his coffin, the other backwards. As the volley resounded, there arose a shriek from the wall of Dr. Grove's garden, and someone fell down inside. But nobody among the spectators without noticed it at the time. The two executed hussars were Matthostina and his friend Christoph. The soldiers on guard placed the bodies in the coffins almost instantly. But the colonel of the regiment, an Englishman, rode up and exclaimed in a stern voice, "Turn them out as an example to the men." The coffins were lifted endwise, and the dead Germans flung out upon their faces on the grass. Then all the regiments wheeled in sections, and marched past the spot in slow time. When the survey was over, the corpses were again coffined, and borne away. Meanwhile, Dr. Grove, attracted by the noise of the volley, had rushed out into his garden, where he saw his wretched daughter lying motionless against the wall. She was taken indoors, but it was long before she recovered consciousness, and for weeks they despaired of her reason. It transpired that the luckless deserters from the York Hussars had cut the boat from her moorings in the adjacent harbor, according to their plan, and, with two other comrades who were smarting under ill treatment from their colonel, had sailed in safety across the channel. But mistaking their bearings, they steered into Jersey, thinking that island the French coast. Here they were perceived to be deserters, and delivered up to the authorities. Matthos and Christoph interceded for the other two at the court-martial, saying that it was entirely by the former's representations that these were induced to go. Their sentence was accordingly commuted to flogging, the death punishment being reserved for their leaders. The visitor to the well-known old Georgian watering place, who may care to ramble to the neighboring village under the hills, and examine the register of burials, will there find two entries in these words. Matthostina Corpl. In His Majesty's Regiment. Of York Hussars, and shot for desertion, was buried June 30, 1801, aged 22 years. Born in the town of Saarbrück, Germany. Christoph Bless, belonging to His Majesty's Regiment. Of York Hussars, who was shot for desertion, was buried June 30, 1801, aged 22 years. Born at Lethargen, Alsatia. Their graves were dug at the back of the little church, near the wall. There is no memorial to mark the spot, but Phyllis pointed it out to me. While she lived, she used to keep their mounds neat, but now they are overgrown with nettles, and sunk nearly flat. The older villagers, however, who know of the episode from their parents, still recollect the place where the soldiers lie. Phyllis lies near. October 1889. The fiddler of the reels, talking of exhibitions, world's fairs, and whatnot, said the old gentleman, "I would not go round the corner to see a dozen of them nowadays. The only exhibition that ever made, or ever will make, any impression upon my imagination, was the first of the series, the parent of them all, and now a thing of old times, the great exhibition of 1851 in Hyde Park, London. None of the younger generation can realize the sense of novelty it produced in us who were then in our prime." A noun substantive went so far as to become an adjective in honor of the occasion. It was exhibition hat, exhibition razor strop, exhibition watch, nay, even exhibition weather, exhibition spirits, sweethearts, babies, wives for the time. For South Wessex, the year formed in many ways an extraordinary chronological frontier transit line, at which there occurred what one might call a precipice in time. as in a geological alt, we had presented to us a sudden bringing of ancient and modern into absolute contact, such as probably in no other single year since the conquest was ever witnessed in this part of the country. These observations led us onward, to talk of the different personages, gentle and simple, who lived and moved within our narrow and peaceful horizon at that time, and of three people in particular, whose queer little history was oddly touched at points by the exhibition, more concerned with it than that of anybody else who dwelt in those outlying shades of the world: Stickleford, Millstock, and Egdon. First in prominence among these three came Wat Olamour, if that were his real name, whom the seniors in our party had known well. He was a woman's man, they said, supremely so, externally little else. To men B was not attractive, perhaps a little repulsive at times. Musician, dandy, and company man in practice, veterinary surgeon in theory, he lodged a while in Millstock village, coming from nobody knew where, though some said his first appearance in this neighborhood had been as fiddle player in a show at Greenhill Fair. Many a worthy villager envied him his power over unsophisticated maidenhood, a power which seemed sometimes to have a touch of the weird and wizardly in it. Personally, he was not ill-favored, though rather un-English, his complexion being a rich olive, his rank hair dark and rather clammy, made still clammier by secret ointments, which, when he came fresh to a party, caused him to smell like boys' love southern wood, steeped in lamp oil. On occasion he wore curls a double row running almost horizontally around his head. But as these were sometimes noticeably absent, it was concluded that they were not altogether of nature's making. By girls whose love for him had turned to hatred, he had been nicknamed Mop, from this abundance of hair, which was long enough to rest upon his shoulders. As time passed, the name more and more prevailed. His fiddling possibly had the most to do with the fascination he exercised, for, to speak fairly, it could claim for itself a most peculiar and personal quality, like that in a moving preacher. There were tones in it which bred the immediate conviction that indolence and averseness to systematic application were all that lay between Mop and the career of a second Paganini. While playing, he invariably closed his eyes, using no notes, and, as it were, allowing the violin to wander on at will into the most plaintive passages ever heard by rustic man. There was a certain lingual character in the supplicatory expressions he produced, which would well nigh have drawn an ache from the heart of a gatepost. He could make any child in the parish, who was at all sensitive to music, burst into tears in a few minutes by simply fiddling one of the old dance tunes he almost entirely affected: country jigs, reels, and favorite quick steps of the last century, some mutilated remains of which even now reappear as nameless phantoms in new quadrilles and gallops, where they are recognized only by the curious, or by such old-fashioned and far between people as have been thrown with men like Wat Olamour in their early life. His date was a little later than that of the old Millstock choir band, which comprised the Deweys, male, and the rest. In fact, he did not rise above the horizon thereabout till those well-known musicians were disbanded as ecclesiastical functionaries. In their honest love of thoroughness, they despised the new man's style. Theophilus Dewey Reuben, the tranter's younger brother, used to say there was no plumbness in it, no bowing, no solidity, it was all fantastical. And probably this was true. Anyhow, Mop had, very obviously, never bowed a note of church music from his birth. He never once sat in the gallery of Millstock Church, where the others had tuned their venerable psalmody so many hundreds of times, had never, in all likelihood, entered a church at all. All were devil's tunes in his repertory. He could no more play the Wold Hundredth to his true time than he could play the Brazen Serpent, the tranter would say. The Brazen Serpent was supposed in Millstock to be a musical instrument particularly hard to blow. Occasionally Mop could produce the aforesaid moving effect upon the souls of grown-up persons, especially young women of fragile and responsive organization. such an one was Carolina Spent. Though she was already engaged to be married, before she met him, Caroline, of them all, was the most influenced by Ma Balamore's heart-stealing melodies, to her discomfort, nay, positive pain and ultimate injury. She was a pretty, invocating, weak-mouthed girl, whose chief defect as a companion with her sex was a tendency to peevishness now and then. At this time she was not a resident in Millstock Parish where Mop lodged, but lived some miles off at Stickleford, farther down the river. How and where she first made acquaintance with him and his fiddling is not truly known, but the story was that it either began or was developed on one spring evening when, in passing through Lower Millstock, she chanced to pause on the bridge near his house to rest herself and languidly leaned over the parapet. Mop was standing on his doorstep, as was his custom, spinning the insidious thread of semi and demi-semi quavers from the E string of his fiddle for the benefit of passers-by, and laughing as the tears rolled down the cheeks of the little children hanging around him. Caroline pretended to be engrossed with the rippling of the stream under the arches, but in reality she was listening, as he knew. Presently the aching of the heart seized her simultaneously with a wild desire to glide airily in the mazes of an infinite dance. To shake off the fascination she resolved to go on, although it would be necessary to pass him as he played. On stealthily glancing ahead at the performer, she found to her relief that his eyes were closed in abandonment to instrumentation, and she strode on boldly. But when closer her step grew timid, her tread convulsed itself more and more accordantly with the time of the melody, till she very nearly danced along. Gaining another glance at him when immediately opposite, she saw that one of his eyes was open, quizzing her as he smiled at her emotional state. Her gait could not divest itself of its compelled capers till as he had gone a long way past the house, and Caroline was unable to shake off the strange infatuation for hours. After that day, whenever there was to be in the neighborhood a dance to which she could get an invitation, and where Ma Balamore was to be the musician, Caroline contrived to be present, though it sometimes involved a walk of several miles, for he did not play so often in Stickleford as elsewhere. The next evidences of his influence over her were singular enough, and it would require a neurologist to fully explain them. She would be sitting quietly, any evening after dark, in the house of her father, the parish clerk, which stood in the middle of Stickleford Village Street, this being the high road between Lower Millstock and Morford, 5 miles eastward. Here, without a moment's warning, and in the midst of a general conversation between her father, sister, and the young man before alluded to, who devotedly wooed her in ignorance of her infatuation, she would start from her seat in the chimney corner, as if he had received a galvanic shock, and spring convulsively towards the ceiling. Then she would burst into tears, and it was not till some half hour had passed that she grew calm as usual. Her father, knowing her hysterical tendencies, was always excessively anxious about this trait in his youngest girl, and feared the attack to be a species of epileptic fit. Not so her sister Julia. Julia had found out what was the cause. At the moment before the jumping, only an exceptionally sensitive ear situated in the Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.